So this is a lecture on Descartes and on the small section that I took from his most famous book, Meditations on First Philosophy. This is the beginning of that that very famous book. I said last week that the cave analogy in Plato's Republic is probably the single most famous moment within Western philosophy. And then I'll add to that this week that this passage from Descartes, where he doubts all of his senses and then tries to persuade himself that he's living in absolute falsity through the through hypothesizing an evil genius, this is probably the second most famous passage from all of Western philosophy. And when you put it together with what we're going to have the following week, with Karl Marx, you've got the basis for a whole lot of movies, but the most obvious one would be the Matrix series, right? The idea that, I mean, you know, anything where, you know, there's an idea of a brain in a vat or a virtual reality, the idea that there's a world of appearances, which people typically buy, but behind that world of appearances, there's some other kind of reality that we got to figure out and that we need to get access to. That's sort of the series that we're looking at here, Plato, Descartes, Marx. Otherwise, you know, all these guys would hate the other ones. Okay, so let me say general things about Descartes, and then I'm basically just going to step through his reasoning here. Who was he? So we're in 1640. He's a Frenchman, and he's riding in Amsterdam, and he's hanging out with kind of royal and highly placed people. It's probably important to recognize one of our writers. I think it's the last writer we read, Huria Butelja, will consider it significant that Descartes is effectively at the center of developing world capitalism at this point. Amsterdam is the center of banking. It's the center of state development. It's the center of keeping records on people. But it's also the center, one of the key centers of capital accumulation at this time. And, you know, getting going on its own colonization and thoroughly invested in the slave trade, which is interesting. Primarily, on first read, it's interesting because of its utter absence from Descartes' philosophy. I think this is an interesting thing about philosophy and maybe something that misled me for a while, and now which I tend to regard as suspicious. This interesting thing is that philosophy, very rarely, except in the case of specifically political philosophy, but even then often, makes no reference to empirical or historical circumstances. It poses as pure thought for thought's sake. And I think when I was younger, I really found that attractive, especially coming out of a religious upbringing and being put off by the kind of dogmatism in that and maybe the sentimentality in that and not convinced by a bunch of the stories, but still persuaded that, you know, a kind of like spiritual or refined existence was the realest one. It's taken me two decades kind of to get over that mentality. But that's one of the things that you're going to see in Descartes is this pretense that nothing is happening that relates to history. It's just about thinking. I mean, yeah, there's a couple of references that to us look historic. He's in, you know, sitting by the fire in a dressing gown and he's holding a candle or a lantern or something. But his considerations have nothing to do with history. They have nothing to do with power. And yet here he is, very privileged, upper class, white man in the center of state power, in the center of the capitalist world. And so the conclusions that he comes up with here about who we really are and what we really are and what we really know, according to him, have nothing to do with this socio-historical, whatever you want to call it, positioning. But maybe it does. And so this is where I'll end up today. Anyway, so let's see. Oh, and you might know of Descartes. For one, you can go check out the South Park episode about this, but you've heard his name even if you didn't recognize it, because probably all of you are familiar with this thing called the Cartesian coordinate system, you know, the kind of mapping that is used in basic mathematics and geometry, where we have an x-axis and a y-axis, and we could add a z-axis. That idea of having axes and plotting points, that's real central to how Descartes views the real world. And when Descartes establishes what it is that people really know in the Meditations, what he's really trying to set up is is an epistemological framework, that is a theory about what knowledge is and what we can have knowledge about, that leads towards codifying all of nature in terms of purely, what would he say, clearly and distinctly understandable things like number, position, mass, velocity, that kind of stuff. Not color, not odor, not secondary qualities, to use the language of Descartes or Locke, but primary qualities, which are in this thought, and from this point forward in European history, what we can clearly and distinctly understand is associated rigorously with mathematical presentation. So we get to the point where we are today, where we tend to think of physics as like the master science and what is really known, and then we recognize that physics is completely expressed in a mathematical language that makes sense to us because of this particular history. Why do I offer Descartes to you? Well, for one thing, because it's a famous and amusing instance of radical questioning, and what Descartes is showing, just like what Plato and Socrates showed us last week, is that you can question anything, and maybe you should, and maybe a person who doesn't question everything, including their senses, including their experience, including their beliefs, is not going to be a free and rational individual. You're likely going to be an exploited and manipulated individual. And again, that consideration about, you know, social manipulation is totally outside the scope of Descartes' concerns. He's just interested in knowledge. Nevertheless, I think, you know, thinking through sequences in which we systematically doubt things can be useful for us in trying to liberate ourselves from an environment where we are systematically told a whole bunch of things that aren't true and which hide a reality which we're not supposed to really inquire into. So I'll suggest that the kind of radical questioning that he does can be scaled up. We can think about it in terms of the senses like he does, and we'll walk through that shortly. But we can also think about it in terms of a political landscape and a media landscape and in terms of classrooms and in various ways, right? The idea is let's identify what we tend to believe is true and let's try to bracket it. This is a later term used by a guy named Edmund Husserl, early 20th century philosopher who was really into Descartes. Let's try and bracket the things that we typically believe in and ask ourselves rationally, what are the things that we really know beyond the shadow of a doubt? And let's see if there's anything there. Why is Descartes also a problem? Well, what Butelja is going to point out is that though figures like Descartes and philosophical figures in general in the Western canon almost always pretend like they're just speaking about truth and that their truths are not impacted by their historical class, gender, racial, whatever positioning, probably they are. Philosophy does not exist outside of history, even though most philosophers seem to be under the delusion that it does. And since we can observe that philosophy exists within particular historical contexts, and I've told you what was the context of Descartes, in the middle of capitalism, in the middle of the rationalization of production and statecraft in Europe, in the middle of the rising slave-based capitalist European colonial system, the conclusions that Descartes arrives at as to who we really are and what we really are maybe are more indicative of his position as a white man at the center of European global capitalist and imperial power than it is a final statement about who we really are. So notice that his conclusions will be totally individualistic. Who I am, my deep essence, same thing for you, is supposedly on Descartes' account totally individual. I really only know myself is the end of this story. And this knowing of myself, which in later philosophy will get the term self-consciousness, which is really interesting in a bunch of ways. You know, the fact that we can reflect upon our own thoughts, that we can think something, you know, have images in our mind or pronounce propositional phrases in our mind, and then look back at it in a recent memory and say, okay, I was just thinking this. Why did I think this? That's pretty interesting. That could be called reflexivity or reflection. A lot of people tend to think that that is central to human cognition. and you know, some of the questions about if and when machines can become human-like or conscious, it really points at their ability to be self-conscious. Nevertheless, I think there is a real problem, which again, Buttigieg will point out for us, about whether this self-consciousness is really so certain and indubitable as Descartes makes out, especially, you know, even his admirer, Edmund Husserl, thought that when Descartes concluded that I know that I exist and I know that I'm my thought, or that I know that I am a thinking thing, is his formulation. Husserl thought that Descartes was making a mistake because he brought the thing there. Yes, perhaps we are thinking, but this does not necessarily authorize us to hypothesize that we are some kind of thing or subject that is doing this thinking. Anyway, from a kind of social political perspective, the idea that a thinking being and a carefully thinking philosophical being who is very knowledgeable and all that can come to rest on his own self-consciousness of himself. Buttigieg is like, that sounds like white people. That sounds like privileged people. Maybe that sounds like male people. Maybe not. Maybe it's not really true. Maybe this is a socially produced sense of insularity and self-certainty. So these are problems. I'm not going to criticize him along these lines any further, but I want to set it up that we should think about both what Descartes gives us in terms of reasoning, but also we should consider Descartes as and his text as an artifact of a particular historical period originating within a particular position within a social political structure. We should never overlook those things. Okay, so now let's get into the text. First of all, he starts off saying, I have resolved, finally, I've put aside some time in order to demolish all of my opinions and try to get down to some foundations. He wants to know, what does he know for sure? Because he knows that there are many things that he once believed that he no longer believes. Now, the historical circumstance into which this epistemological consideration fits is the fact that Descartes is a part of a new scientific paradigm within European culture and thought, which is really distinct, not as distinct as he thought, but really distinct from like medieval science. In class the other day, I pointed out that, you know, if Aristotle was going to explain what we would call gravity, he would actually say that, okay, the thing falls, the heavy thing falls because it's earthy and it wants to be with earth, right? Shifting to claim that this is gravity, which is not yet how people are talking about around Descartes. We're in between, you know, the Renaissance and Newton here. But this is a major shift. There's a major shift happening. And the way that medieval thinkers understood the world is no longer the way that these rationalist early modern thinkers, which is what we would call the period beginning middle 1500s or something, believe. So the old science is no good. The old science was all related to God, too. It had historically Aristotelian and Platonic ways of looking at the world had historically been interlaced with religious and particularly Christian ways of looking at the world. And in the Islamic world, this happened particularly by knitting together Aristotle and the Quran. So the systems of science, although again in the Islamic world, actually mathematics and astronomy were really advanced, a lot of the other ways of looking at the natural world relied upon revealed text, relied upon religious understandings, relied upon dogmas. And from a rationalist perspective, dogmas are unacceptable. So Descartes' question is, okay, we just came out of this period and now we're seeing that those understandings of the world are not, they don't seem valid anymore. We want a new science. But how are we going to make sure that our science rests upon firm foundations such that it is not going to end up becoming, you know, being shown obsolete and erroneous just like this last system was? So there are some assumptions in here, but there are also some understandable starting points. The understandable starting point is, okay, we realize that our opinions have been wrong in the past. So how are we going to make sure that our opinions are solid now? The assumption, and this isn't too important for our very beginning approach here, but the assumption is an epistemological one, and that is that knowledge rests upon foundations, that there are like first principles, and if we understand these first principles, we can base other things upon them. Not all theories of knowledge proceed along those lines. For example, you could have a coherence theory of truth, which just says that something is true insofar as it doesn't contradict the other things that we have accepted as true. In that case, you're not basing knowledge upon first foundations. Anyway, Descartes is assuming that knowledge is based upon first foundations, and then Meditations on First Philosophy is therefore an inquiry into what these first foundations can be. And along the way, he's going to try and dismiss some of the basic ideas that the philosophical and, you know, which at this point is pretty much the same thing as the scientific tradition have offered. In particular, he's going to try and resist Christian understandings and Aristotelian understandings. Although in the end, by the way, I think Descartes' understanding is kind of still commensurable with Christianity. Like, we don't have this passage here, but he still believes in God. He thinks you can prove the existence of God. He certainly doesn't have any interest in talking about Christ or biblical stuff, but he does think that the soul is, you know, immortal and distinct from the body. These are still commensurable with this old system. These are the things that he tends not to notice very much. Anyway, so here's the famous sequence. He has retired into solitude, and perhaps, you know, this is something that he's recommending all of us should do at least once in our life, is to pause, take some time, you know, take a week when you're on vacation by yourself, if you're so lucky, or when, you know, you're sick at home for a week and you don't have anything to do. Take some time to think through what you always believed and to try and identify the most basic things that you've believed, and then throw those into question and ask, how do I know that? Am I sure about that? And if not, is there anything that I'm sure about? What do I know for sure? And once you come to some conclusions about what you know for sure, Descartes thinks you're in a better position to move forward and not be deceived in the future, and maybe to carefully distinguish in the future between what you know for sure and what you only believe, hypothetically or whatever. So withdraw into solitude, demolish your opinions. And the way that he says, he's like, okay, you couldn't think through all your beliefs. There are too many of them. But we can go for the source of a whole bunch of those beliefs, and then we will have systematically thrown all of them into question. And the source that he's talking about is the senses, right? We feel like we know the world through our vision, primarily. And that's an interesting thing, too. That's historically variable, by the way. Different cultures thought differently about which senses were more important or which ones gave access to truth. But in the Western philosophical and scientific tradition, it's almost always been vision. We take vision, you know, Aristotle thought that vision was the queen of the senses. Anyway, so a whole bunch of the stuff that we think that we know about the world, we got through seeing and hearing. But what if seeing and hearing in themselves weren't entirely dependable? So he starts thinking, has my seeing or hearing ever deceived me? And you can think this one through, right? And I think you're going to have to come to the answer that yes, there have been times when I thought I saw something, but then I realized that what I thought I saw wasn't really there. You know, you wake up in the middle of the night and maybe you had a bad dream and you're looking at shadows in your room and you're sure that the shadow is a figure. You turn on the light and no, it's just a shadow thrown by, you know, your coat that was hanging wherever. That's a sensory illusion, right? Or from a distance, maybe you look at the one that Descartes gives you look at a round tower and you understand, like you see it as square or the other way around. Or another example he gives, you know, if you were to see robots walking in the distance, you might immediately perceive those as humans, but then when you got close, you'd be like, oh man, that's not actually human, that's a robot. The key point to recognize with respect to all of these things, by the way, is that we tend to think that we just see what's out there, but actually we are making judgments about what we're seeing, and it's the judgment that constitutes the perception. It's the judgment that we believe in, right? I'm hanging out on campus, and somebody I know is coming towards me, and I wave. And then they get a bit closer and I feel a little bit embarrassed because this person is wondering why I waved at them, because they're not the person I thought that they are. Maybe they had some similarity, the way they walked, the way their hair was, whatever it is. But I made a mistake. We perceive erroneously. And then Descartes's like, okay, but maybe that's only true, you know, like at a distance or in bad lighting. But right now, like I'm looking at the computer screen and I'm watching the waveform of this recording unfold. Like, that's clear and distinct, right? So I can be sure of that, right? And then here's the next signature shift. Well, yeah, it seems like that's pretty clear, except I've dreamt about giving lectures before. You know, I've dreamt about making recordings of lectures before. I have, because I've done this a lot, right? Things that we've done a lot, varieties of experience that we've been involved in, and a whole bunch of other things. We've dreamt about them. You ever had a dream where you wake up inside the dream, and so everything from there out seems super realistic, but then it gets all like wonky and squirrely and weird and creepy. And it's super scary because you think that you're awake and then you wake up again, right? The point about that is that that's an instance where we're really dreaming, but we really think that we're awake. So in a dream, when we're really in a dream, we always think that this is real experience. Now, if that's true, then you get the famous Cartesian question, which is, how do you know that you're not dreaming right now? How do you know that you're really listening to a lecture by Matt in this intro to philosophy course at a place called Dominguez Hills? How do you know? Do you know? And Descartes' suggestion is, if there's any chance that it could be false, then we got to admit that our knowledge with respect to you know, that you're really listening to a lecture, or that I'm really giving one, that's not certainty. It's likely, sure. You know, most of the time my dreams are not so coherent or whatever. But I don't know. According to Descartes, you don't know that what's happening with you right now is real. You could be dreaming. Okay, so then he starts thinking, okay, so even if I was dreaming, could there be anything certain for me while I'm dreaming? And he does a little like shout out right here to what his real interest is. And he won't come back to this until the end of the meditations, which we're not reading. But he says, okay, well, even if I was dreaming, wouldn't it have to be the case that the things that are populating my dream, like I'm looking around my office and I got my books and I got my speakers and I got my synthesizer and I got my notebook and I got the bottle cap from some mineral water I had before, right? Even if I'm not really awake right now, mustn't it be the case that these things, these books and instruments and notebooks, that I did perceive them once, right? Or at least that things like them exist. And so I can be sure, can't I be sure that there does exist a material world, there exists space and time. And then he gives this list, and he's like, don't I know that there's corporeal nature, which means extended, and depending on which philosopher of this period you read, maybe impenetrable, you know, exerting a force of resistance, this kind of stuff, that's Locke. Extension, that means like occupying space. That's in Descartes, that's the core feature of the material world, is that it is spatial. All, you can't have a physical object that does not occupy space and operate in space. And then he gives this list of really things that he ultimately will believe in, and that he thinks that science, real science, and especially physics, have to deal with. And I'll say, okay, shape, quantity and size, location, duration. He's like, and these are the things that we know are studied by physics and astronomy and medicine and arithmetic and geometry. And at least, especially if you get over to, you know, arithmetic, don't I know for certain that 2 + 3 = 5? So maybe I arrived here at what I know for sure. You know, the basic elements of the physical world, the basic truths of mathematical reasoning. And then he's like, okay, wait, I can doubt that too. And here he makes this interesting strategic use of the notion of God. So God becomes a bad guy, first of all, in the meditations, and then he's recovered as a good guy. And actually, the meditations don't work. You don't get back to any kind of, like, you know, scientific certainty about your experience or the real world except by means of God in this meditation, which is really interesting, and we can talk about that in class if you want. I'll try and map out like how he thinks that's true, and it'll show you how weak how weak his suppositions are, and that might just throw us back into the position where, oh man, so maybe we really don't know anything, which in a lot of ways is how you get from Descartes to later philosophers, 100 years later, Kant, 150 to 200 years later, no, 250 years later, Nietzsche. They really think that we don't know much of anything, and the things that we experience are aspects of our own cognition and our own way of patterning the world, but we don't really know the way that the world is in itself. Anyway, Descartes doesn't go there, but he does introduce God now, and he says, okay, but wait, I have this idea about God. I remember being told about this character that he's like an omnipotent being or whatever. He has all power. He can do anything he wants, and if he could do anything that he wants, couldn't he make me think that I'm certain even when I'm wrong? So what if 2 + 3 doesn't equal 5? I mean, there's nobody listening to this who earnestly could disbelieve it, right? Because you can put up 2 fingers on one hand and 3 fingers on the other, and then you can count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That looks pretty darn clear. But Descartes's like, well, but if there is an omnipotent being, by definition, that being could make you believe in things which are patently false. So this is where he ends. Meditation number one. He's like, okay, I'm just going to remember, I have destroyed everything. I am now in utter doubt. And remember, this is like really important for philosophy, right? Like, you got to recognize your own ignorance. You got to reduce yourself to a state of ignorance. You got to doubt things that you thought were certain if you want to get to a position where you can come to understand them better. So how am I going to hold on to this position, or how does Descartes do this? The answer is, let's pretend there's what he calls an evil genius. So this is like God is a bad guy. Imagine that there is an all-powerful being, and the whole job of this all-powerful being, or the whole game that this being is playing, is about making you believe that you're whoever you think you are, wherever you think you are, whenever you think you are, knowing whatever you think you know, and yet it's all false. You see how this is like the basis for, you know, narratives like The Matrix. That we could be living inside a virtual reality and we don't know it. Or we could be a brain inside a vat that just has a bunch of electrodes attached to it. And we're being fed these experiences. And of course, the reality of things like that is getting closer and closer too, right? And blind people can see by means of wires to their occipital cortex. And that means that they could be sent electrically false visual data. Maybe they even have been as part of those tests. Anyway, so I can't believe anything. Okay, now we come back, and it's meditation two. And he says, okay, let me remember, I was in this bad situation. Even the things that I think are true, that like I know very clearly what the material world is. I know that it has to do with space, and it has to do with shape, and it has to do with quantity. And when I deal with these things, geometrical figures and numbers, I feel very at home, and I feel very trusting with this kind of language and description. It seems to me like it's clear and distinct. That will be Descartes' epistemological language later in the meditations, clear and distinct. And yet I'm in this problem situation because I realized, well, it could be that I was being systematically deceived. So now the question becomes, if I am being systematically deceived, if you are being systematically deceived and you are not where you are not in the body that you think that you are in. And notice that that falls apart with the dreaming too, right? You ever have a dream that you were younger or older? I have. The older you get, the more you know, you'll have dreams about like earlier in your life, and then you wake up and holy cow, you're an old person. But a minute ago you weren't. You were deluded about that in the dream. Anyway, so we're pretending that there exists an evil being who is lying to us all the time. And the question becomes, if I am assuming that everything I'm seeing, everything I'm hearing, everything I'm feeling from my body is systematically false, can there be anything left that I know? And here's the famous answer. Well, I know that I exist. I have to be here. There has to be a me. Because if there weren't a me, there couldn't be illusion and deception. So whether or not what I am believing and what I think I am perceiving are true, even if I am being deceived, a non-existent being cannot be deceived. Therefore, I know that I exist. And this is the first certainty in Descartes. Now notice, let's step outside of Descartes' reasoning again and take the critical kind of socio-political view on this. Notice that the starting point for who I am and what I know and all that is individual. This has nothing to do with you. I don't know anything about you. This will later be phrased as like the problem of other minds. How do I know that other people exist? And that assumes that the fundamental reality is always an individual reality. That's something worth asking about. I think in a lot of ways it makes sense, but in some other ways it's not necessarily correct. But it is part of capitalist and statist ideology that the individual is the fundamental unit of organization. Next, I know that I exist. I have this certainty. And so then the question becomes, okay, if I know that I exist, well, what do I mean by I? What is this I that exists? And so then we get a list again. And the list is basically referring to a couple of traditions that have, up until Descartes' time, tried to answer this question. What is the human being? What is human nature? What are humans really? And one answer is coming straight from Aristotle. And Aristotle's answer, his definition of humans, is that humans are rational animals. So we're animals. We share a lot of functions in common with other animals. We reproduce sexually, and we eat, and we excrete, and we grow, and we die, and then we deteriorate, like all other animals, and in the last instance, like everything else in the natural world. And yet there is a feature of us which distinguishes us, according to Aristotle and according to this whole tradition, which, let's step outside the reasoning again, could be a kind of excuse for the violent usage of all living things in the world. If we separate ourselves as being qualitatively different from them, maybe that's a kind of ideological justification for what we do with them. But anyway, okay, I'll jump back into the reasoning. Aristotle thought that we were a rational animal. But Descartes says, then I would have to investigate what an animal is and what rationality means. And I can't get into all that. And anyway, like my certainty right now is like really direct and simple, right? I know that I'm here. I know that I am experiencing something. Even if every little bit of what I'm experiencing is false, I know that I'm here. I can't be nothing. Now, my question is like, what is that simple I? And then he tries out another suggestion. He's like, what about my body? A lot of people think that they and their body are the same thing, right? Although I'll point out to you, you know, along Platonic lines, when you talk to somebody else, don't you distinguish between their body and who they are? When you look in a mirror, don't you distinguish between what you see in the mirror and who you are? Perhaps it really is the case that human being is not an objective phenomenon like bodies are. Anyway, he's like, I ruled this one out already, right? Because, like, I don't know I'm a body. Like, I could be, maybe I'm a kangaroo and I'm dreaming that I'm this, like, French philosopher. Who knows? Can't be that. And then he's like, what about a soul? He's like, so now it's the religious tradition, right? It's the Christian tradition, the Catholic tradition, Catholic and Protestant tradition. I'm a soul. And he's just harsh about that. He's like, that is a fuzzy term. That's not good science. That's not good philosophy. We don't want to use terms we don't know what we're talking about. We always got to define our terms and make them clean. But soul is a fundamentally incoherent concept. What does it mean? Like some kind of wind or breath or fire or something? No good. But now we get the conclusion. He's like, okay, actually, all this time, the answer has been staring me right in the face. What am I really? I am a thinking thing. And if you wanted to put this really simply, I am essentially a mind. But I'm a thinking thing. And all the different things that are going on with me imagining Descartes sitting by the fire, me imagining being in the classroom with you all, me remembering where I was before I came up here into my office, me seeing what I think I'm seeing right now, the computer screen and the microphone, all of these things have to be recodified as cognitive acts. They're just manners of thinking. And I don't necessarily know that the content, the object of my thought, is real. But I do know that the thinking is happening. So how's that work? Like, first of all, step out of the narrative for a moment. Notice that Descartes has imported, and a whole lot of Western philosophy does this, and a bunch of contemporary cognitive scientists and analytic philosophers still think this way. He's brought in the idea that thought is always dualistic in nature, that there is a thinker, which he understands as a kind of thinking thing, or a mind, which is like a cognitive material or something, and that thinking thing's object. Right? So think of a tea kettle. Okay, there's you facing in your mind the tea kettle. The tea kettle is the content of your thought, but the awareness of the tea kettle is distinct from its object. And you may be thinking of a real tea kettle that you saw earlier today, or you may be thinking of an abstracted tea kettle, or one that's built out of a composite of images you've seen in the past. So it may be like a tea kettle that really exists in the world, or one that never has. The content can be false, but the fact that you are thinking of that tea kettle cannot be false. That's your reality. So this is the answer. You are a thinking thing. I am a thinking thing. And on the basis of this knowledge of myself as a thinking thing, Descartes hopes that we can go on and rebuild other other certainties. In fact, the meditations have to pass through the idea of God and prove the existence of God and prove the goodwill of God, that he is not an evil genius deceiving us, before we actually get back any real certainty at all. Let me throw in one last thing, because this is toward the end of the reading I gave you. Notice that we tend to think that we know the physical world, the perceived world, better than anything. Most people take this as common sense, right? You know, if I asked you, or I did ask you at the beginning of the class, what do you know for sure, right? You know, an easy answer to that question is like, well, I know I'm sitting here answering this question. I know that, you know, my cell phone is charging on the desk next to me because I can see it. That's knowledge. Is like, you know, it's like the most knowable stuff is the physical world. And then he does this also kind of famous, interesting thought experiment. And he's like, okay, so if you know things by your senses, what about a lump of wax? Pick up the lump of wax. It has a particular shape. It has a particular texture. It has a particular color. It has a particular odor, right? So this is how early modern philosophers often think about the physical world. There's like a substance, the real thing, and then this substance has certain predicates or features. So the features that I can see are, they correspond to my senses, right? If I tap on the wax, he says, it gives a little tappy noise. If I smell it, it's got a slightly sweet scent from the honeycomb. Each one of the things that seem to be true about this object that I'm looking at comes via a different sense. But then he's like, okay, so if you think that the reality of the wax is given in all of those dimensions of sensory perception, then what happens when you melt the wax? Well, everything that you knew before, the smell, it's gone. The texture, it's changed. It gets softer and then it turns into liquid. The sound, when the wax gets really soft, it doesn't make any sound at all. The shape is totally altered. The color is different, either slightly or extremely. And yet every person who watches this wax be deformed by the flame would still say it's got to be the same wax afterwards as before. Why? Because what you are believing in when you believe in things in the external world is not really those things in the world. There may be sensory processes going on, but on the basis of these sensory processes, on the basis of the way they would put it is your reception of certain qualities. There you go. That's probably the better term. Substance and its qualities. A subject and its predicates. Substance and its qualities. Those qualities are reaching you via the senses. But then what you know or what you believe in as being out there is actually an aspect of your judgment. It's your thought which perceives. And what you perceive, though in many cases we feel that it's the same as what we're looking at, it's actually not. we are making judgments based on some kind of sensory input, but the reality that we see, you know, what I think like you are when I talk to you, I don't actually know. And it's not given in what I see of you. It's not given in the gestures that I see you make, although I tend to think it is. Like, there's a person who, you know, is a little bit, you know, I don't know, pushy, or the other, like, lacks self-confidence based on the gestures that I see from you. But the truth is, I can be totally wrong about that stuff, because what I am believing about you is from my judgment, my memory, my way of understanding. We don't, so the big scale conclusion here is, we don't know the physical world first of all. We know it only through thought. And what we know best, and what we are, and where we are most at home, and where certainty resides, is purely in a mental realm of thought.